The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
The last 8-9 years, there's been no chaos. What's the need? Let's have a robo-advisor. Let's have artificial intelligence manage our money for us. And in a perfect world where prices are marching higher and there's no resistance to the march of progress, maybe that works. But in a period where you begin to see a market sell-off, it's much easier to rationalize the engagement of a professional in that way.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, welcome back, Dave. You've had quite an adventure since the last time you were in the studio.
Currents and waves. Yeah. Lots of them.
You swam the channel between Nevis and St. Kitts?
Yeah, about a 2.5 mile gap through the shallows, but some decent currents, and on certain days with a little bit of breeze, it'll roll you a little bit.
You said it was a little choppy. You know, we had done that half Ironman in Hapuna Bay in Hawaii, and it was like swimming on glass. It was beautiful. But you said that in this particular case, you sort of had to pay attention to the tide current a little bit.
Yeah, no, and I absolutely did. But it was a great challenge, and about twice the distance that you and I've done in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And longest I've done in open water so far.
Well, you know, you slayed another giant. I remember 2 years ago you talking about, wow, I saw people doing that, and I think I'd like to do that. And I looked at you like you were crazy, and here you are. So it reminds me, I was reading Fred Hickey the other day, and he was talking about something in relation to tides. And he said, you know, when I'm in Costa Rica, there are times when I go out and I walk the ocean. And he said, you know, if I went out every time when the tide was high, I would think the tide
was always high.
The problem is the tide isn't always high. And what he did was he likened that to the market conditions over the last 8 years. And he said, you know, the guys in this marketplace, the guys who are running the money or at least the algorithms, they've never seen tide go out. They've only walked outside when the tide was high.
Well, in terms of appreciating market dynamics and the ebbs and flows of the market, I'd encourage you to register for the tactical short quarterly call at mwealthm.com. That is next Thursday, April 19th. Doug Noland and I are going to review market dynamics, trade tariffs, and higher rates. That'll be at 4:30 Eastern Standard Time. And you can either go to our website or click on the link there on our page and learn how our tactical short has become, in our opinion, the smartest hedge for a long equity portfolio.
Well, and that's partially for when the tide goes out, is it not?
Yeah, as volatility increases, as valuations push the outer bounds of reason, it'll help you learn how we're managing the tactical short as a hedging tool, mm-hmm. and opportunistically as a moneymaker as stocks sell off. This is by far the most challenging environment Doug has ever been in. 25, 30 years of experience, and this is putting him to the test. And you don't want to miss the conversation. He is alive and excited and absolutely intrigued by the dynamics in play. If you want, submit your questions ahead of time if you would like for them to be aired.
Well, as I was saying, you know, when the tide goes out, you have to react differently. Whether you're a boat captain or whether you're swimming a channel, it's a different factor. And you said that you had currents that you had to deal with as well. In a way, the last 8 years in the financial markets have not really had any challenge. There's no current because the Federal Reserve has just smoothed things over with quantitative easing and the artificial lowering of interest rates. And so I would highly recommend our listeners listen to you and Doug Noland talk. Again, that's at 4:30 Eastern Standard Time.
Remember to register ahead of time.
You know, Dave, while you were swimming the channel, we were playing the program with Becker Pulverini, just trying to make people aware of what's going on in the cyberspace world. And that is a truly real world, as intangible as it feels. We're losing our privacies very, very quickly. And, you know, while you were over there, we had the Facebook thing blow up. So the timing was perfect in having Becker Pulverini on this show.
Right. So whether it's internet privacy or the sociological changes resulting from social media interactions, that may feel like it's big picture stuff, but it's very important. It's very important for us. It's also important for how we engage in the markets. In the markets, we saw Facebook, which, as you say, was criticized for privacy issues,
right,
down 18%. From early February.
Yeah, so it's not just being aware of what they're doing, but it did have to do with the markets after all.
Yeah, and at the same time, Facebook has had to deal with ongoing concerns. This gets to the core of its business model over advertising reach legitimacy? Are there people who are actually viewing the videos and clicking on the links, or is it bots and robots? And so there is an inflation of views and viewing time in the videos. Varying assessments have been that that inflation of numbers could be anywhere from 20% to as high as 60 to 80% inflated. The claim there would be fraud. And frankly, that does damage their business model if this sticks.
One of the things I remember my dad asking me all the time, he could not understand the internet because he said, how in the world do they make money? If all of this is free, why is this happening? And I think what we see is the way that you actually bring the dollars and cents in is either you charge people for clicks, and that's what Facebook is doing, and then now they're being accused of having robots doing that and still charging, or you monetize people's personal data. Now, Twitter is being accused of that at this point.
Yeah, and just one more thing on Facebook. They also had, while I was gone, the executive memo leaked, which was rationalizing terrorist use of the platform, and that has not gone over very well either. But the greater good would be served by the platform, so all of these bad things that might be tag-alongs, we have to live with them.
Yeah.
So, and again, it just didn't go over well, and I think, as you mentioned, Twitter, on the positive side, they've earned $400 million on a gross basis from data licensing. What is data licensing? We've learned from Becker in recent weeks that that is really, it's a euphemism for monetizing and selling individuals' personal profile and online information.
We talk about things coming for free, too, online, and these companies have not necessarily had to be profitable for a long, long period of time. I mean, we've talked about Tesla, but even Twitter, that's not been a profitable company now until this last quarter, I don't think.
Well, that's right. After 12 years of being in existence, they just had their first profitable quarter, thanks to that, again, reselling of your data, otherwise known as data licensing.
I mentioned Tesla. Tesla hasn't had to really have a profit either. I mean, we've talked about how their stock continues to go up, but they continue to lose money.
You know, the boys and I love to watch SpaceX and love to watch what we're now doing to feed the International Space Station. And Musk is involved with that. And it's absolutely fascinating. And, I, you know, just as you had a fascination with space as a young boy, I'm watching their eyes grow wide as saucers as they watch rockets not only take off, but then land themselves again for reuse later. I mean, it really is, there's some marvelous things happening, but one of the most marvelous things that could happen for his other company, Tesla, is that they do turn a profit. Hasn't happened yet. They're down by 34%
since
September.
Yes, but they did launch a convertible into space. I mean, give them that.
Well, of course, that's unique. Yeah, I suppose. If you don't have to turn a profit, you can just launch crud into space. But they've got 123,000 vehicles that are being recalled. And again, it doesn't help them. Having reached a peak in September of 2017, they've been in a downward trend since then. And I think it was notable this last week, there was press coverage of the Saudis looking at sort of a post-oil economy. And they're in talks with Richard Branson, also an innovator, also a serial entrepreneur, but they're not in talks with Elon Musk. And you know, Branson, quite frankly, has more winners than losers at this point. And Musk, I think, is to some degree still riding the credit boom and relying on investor hope. At least he's been accessing the markets for more and more credit and capital from investors to run his businesses because they are not running themselves on a profitable basis yet.
You know, I think of 1999 when people really felt like they were out of it, you know, socially, if they weren't captivated by the latest technology. So we had this tech stock bubble and things were coming up that seemed unreal, but they were more profitable than things that were real. And what we've had is this fanaticism now for Bitcoin, Ethereum, VeChain, this whole blockchain technology formed in cryptocurrencies. I think we need to look back just a single quarter. I mean, really just a quarter to the size. Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general, they were over 825 billion strong as far as capitalization. That's changed, hasn't it?
Well, that's right. So the peak in December of 2017, if you added them all together, mashed them all together, 1,597 different cryptocurrencies had a total market value of 825 billion. Currently, it's sitting around 253 billion. So, you know, for most stock market practitioners, they view 20% as a pretty serious correction. So I guess the question is, what is 70%? Because that's what we've had. Is that a collapse? Anecdotally, I must say, 9 out of 10 people I know who have really bet the farm on cryptocurrencies, they still own everything they did before the decline. And I think because of that, there is another round of selling which is possible. Think about what's involved in a capitulation. Capitulation is one part price action where the price is declining, but it's one part psychological revulsion as well. And the revulsion in the cryptocurrency world is far, far off. You have that fanaticism which it hasn't been damaged at all. Of course, the uses of at least a few of these cryptocurrencies will continue to have a profoundly disruptive impact on the way things are logged and tracked and remembered. But remember the price action of late 2017, October, November, December, radical spikes to all-time highs. That took place in a broader context. It took place in the broader context of a final push higher in a 9-year-old equity bull market. Mm-hmm. So you've got enthusiasm and bullishness in general, which found a focal point more narrow than, say, the biotech or the social media or the AI. It found a focal point in the cryptocurrencies, in a currency maybe soon to be or want to be. But now what are the big headwinds? The big headwinds going forward are central bank and regulator crackdowns, which are going to be very tough to work around. My suggestion is that the ones that survive will survive only if they have been co-opted.
Well, and speaking of tech that, you know, now has to fear the government in a way, Amazon right now is in a fight, not with the post office, but with the Oval Office.
It leaves you pretty vulnerable in the marketplace because governments, when they decide to interfere, it's a big deal. All you have to ask is the oil conglomerates and the rail barons of old how the fight with DC actually felt. And I, you know, look, Amazon's got a market cap north of $725 billion. Mm-hmm. Can it maintain that? I mean, now we're talking about a fight. As you mentioned, this is Oval Office. This is a street fight. And I think time will tell if they can maintain that kind of market cap. But you've got bear market pressures emerging in equities and then political pressure rising. My suggestion is they cannot maintain that value.
We talked about the difference between the virtual and the real, you know, an underappreciated move since December of 2015. I mean, the last couple of years has been the gold miners.
Well, 2016 was the year that put them back on the radar. 2017, fairly lackluster, and nothing really to speak of here in 2018 either. But off of the lows in December 2015, the gold mining sector has outperformed the NASDAQ 100. I mean, this is amazing because the NASDAQ 100 can do no wrong. And yet on a relative basis, during that time frame, the gold mining sector has outperformed the NASDAQ 100. I don't think anybody's noticed. And this small niche sector in the natural resources is, in our estimation, going to be the big winner over the next 2 to 3 years. If you're looking at a speculation, and as tech faces challenges of an extended multi-year bear market decline, I think gold marches to new highs, and it takes some of these miners with them.
You know, I remember 31 years ago before I actually took this job, Dave. You know, we've joked about it before because I applied 3 times. I went through the interview process, and over time, I was accepted into the family, you know, as far as the ICA and McIlvaney, and it's been a great ride. But I remember when I was thinking about, is this a career change that I want to make? I was trying to understand what it was that we did, what we do. And I thought about history. All of world history sort of goes from a representation of wealth or value to the real thing, and then back to the representation to the real thing. Now, I'm counting paper currencies as sort of a representation, debt, you know, paper representations of things. What we do here, actually, for the most part, is the real thing. I mean, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, we talk about oil. We still live in a world where you need real things. Now, why would we be negative necessarily on tech? You know, we've shifted with the tech industry, which is mainly a virtual type of thing. Most technology is virtual. We've shifted from that after the crash of the NASDAQ, you know, what we call the tech stock bubble crashing back in 2000 when I was talking about before. But at this point, tech seems to be doing something very similar to what we had back in 1999 before that crash.
Well, so over a long period of time, you're right. What we see is a migration of money. And it's a migration of money depending on a particular popularity of a theme or growth in demographics or organic growth within an economy. Why we're negative on tech? Because it seems that the kiss of death is often success, where you see a migration towards one area or one sector within the economy. And when any sector grows to an overweighted or bloated level, it's almost as if it's gotten ahead of itself. And it then has to sort of allow everything else to catch up. So that either means it stays put and doesn't grow anymore, or it actually recedes in value. So you think of the gold market in the 1970s, it exceeded 25% of the value of the S&P 500. You look at different times where either tech or financial stocks have also gone north of 25% of the entire index. And when any sector grows to be an overweighted component north of 25%, it has grown beyond a reasonable weighting relative to its economic contribution. And in that sense, has become a speculative magnet, attracted too much interest. It has pushed prices in that sector to levels that are nearly impossible to maintain. So the overall tech sector today is north of 27%. It has doubled its percentage of the index, the S&P 500, over the last 6 years, and is to the point where you say, well, where does it go from here? I mean, this is, again, a question of monetary migration, but it's about time to see the migration to something else.
Well, and as we see this migration, maybe we're going from the virtual now back to the physical, but I can't help but think about silver. You know, the way we view silver here within the walls of this office is every time we buy silver, we're actually thinking about doubling our gold. That's what we think when we think about silver. But silver really has lagged behind gold over the last 2 years.
I understand the importance of technology in the sense that people migrate there because they see an infinite horizon, infinite possibilities, all of the changes. I mean, when you think about Moore's Law and the speed with which things are changing.
Every 18 months, doubling the data capacity.
It's very difficult to argue that tech has a very big future. But where you see a shift back towards tangibles and away from, let's call it an intangible or more ethereal wealth, it's when there's concerns, right? So it's based on concerns that people look at gold and silver and say, I just need to have something in my hot little hand, something that is real, something that is physical, something that I can, it's the same reason that people buy farmland or art or things that are substantial, because you just gain some comfort from presence versus, again, ones and zeros in the digital ether. Well, silver has lagged gold for 2 years. And I guess another way of saying that is it's underperformed terribly for 2 years. And I don't expect that to continue. You know, over the last year, silver's down $2. If you go back 12 months, it made its way into the $18 range, and here it is, $1.50, $2 lower than that. But I don't expect that to continue. The ratio currently between gold and silver is above 80 to 1, 60 to 1, north of 60 to 1. There is a compelling value play in silver relative to gold with a very rare stretch of that number to 100 to 1. And this is a ratio that we play over time to maximize ounces. And it takes years to play out as the ratio swings from one extreme, a low number, to a high number, anything north of 60. And it's obviously most effective to play that ratio in tax-deferred accounts where the exchange has no tax consequence.
Like an IRA.
Yeah, and it's a game that we play for free ounces over time. If you're positioned in metals for a long period, I think you should talk to our team about maximizing the ratio if you haven't already.
Yeah, sort of the maxim is if you want twice as much gold in a few years, buy silver now at this ratio.
That's right. And there's a curious set of numbers from the COT reports, which the commodity traders, you know, there's different segments within the commodity trading segments playing the paper market. We're talking about futures contracts only. But there are speculative shorts and longs. There are commercial shorts and longs, the folks who are actually in the business of.
They may even be working for a silver mine and trying to hedge the mine.
Sure, sure. So the commercial traders who are often early in their positioning, just remember that they're very rarely wrong. Hmm. And we've reached a new all-time low net short position in your commercial traders.
So what does that mean? That means that they're not betting that it's going any further down?
That's right. It means the group has assumed the downside in silver is minimal and the upside is worth waiting for. So what do? You take your shorts minus your longs and divide that by the interest. And again, that puts the net short position in the first quarter of 2018 at the lowest levels recorded ever. And by ever, we mean going back to the period of time when that data was first kept, 1986, when that log was started.
Well, and not to at all neglect gold. In fact, just this afternoon, we received boxes of gold's next wave, the special report that you wrote, Dave, that we're happy to send to listeners. In fact, we should talk about that.
Well, the next wave has already begun. I mean, we're 30% into a significant move higher for gold. And I think transition from being off the radar for investors to glaringly obvious and on the radar for most investors will be the break above 1400. Really 1370-ish, but 1400 sets what is likely to be a 2 to 3 year trend. And I think above that number, adding $1,000 an ounce is going to take less time than it has taken going from 1000 to 1300. And we talk about some of those dynamics in that special report. The context is really set for that third wave. If you're interested, feel free to give us a call and we'll send it out to you.
Yeah, so call that number, 800-525-9556. Just let them know that you want to have gold's next wave and we'll be happy to send that to you. You know, each crash that we've been through, and Dave, you know, most financial industries, the guys who are working there may have only gone through one crash, if even that, in their career. Okay. And so when we go through crashes, a lot of times we have to say, okay, well, experience matters. Have you ever been through this before? If someone's managing your money and the stock market's down 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 points, you know, you're going to want to know that the guy who's managing your money has been through that before.
Yeah, I was born in 1974 at the tail end of a recession in the middle of a crash. And I have to tell you, I don't really remember much of it. But I do remember a little bit more of the crash in 87 because of just kind of the weird dynamics of our house and the things that we would talk about around the dinner table. Right. But I really remember 2000 because that's when I started to cut my teeth on Wall Street with Morgan Stanley. And then, of course, 2007, 2008, we were smack dab in the middle of it as well. So I've seen two already, but more than 50%, according to Mark Faber, more than 50% of the people employed in the financial sector today have never experienced a bear market. And you know, having experienced managers working with you in the context of chaos, it's critical. Now, you can say, well, look, the last 8-9 years, there's been no chaos. What's the need? Let's have a robo-advisor. Let's have artificial intelligence manage our money for us. And look, all I can say is in a perfect world where prices are marching higher and there's no resistance to the march of progress, right, that kind of march of progress, maybe that works. But in a challenging period, in a period where you begin to see a market sell-off, I think that's where all of a sudden it's much easier to rationalize the engagement of a professional in that way.
Well, and just on the top of my head, I mean, just thinking about this office and the McIlvany Wealth Office, you've got Doug Noland, you've got Dave Burgess. These guys have seen 2 to 3 crashes themselves. I can think of 3 crashes that I've been at this company through starting in 1987, and I can think of a handful of people here at the office.
3 to 4.
3 to 4.
Right.
So, yeah, there is experience, but there's something else, though, Dave. It's not just the market managers that haven't been through a bear market. You've got a whole slew of baby boomers that have retired who've never been through a bear market while they were retired.
And that's the key, because they saw it in 2001 and they had time to recover. And they saw it in 2007
because they were working.
And they've had time to recover. But the reality is there is not sufficient time to recover, yeah, should they find themselves in that awkward position. So I think the bear market is going to season many a young investment professional, and I think it's going to separate many a boomer from their retirement hopes and dreams. And in some respects, it'll carry the elements of the bear that stretched from 1968 to 1981. Hmm. You had the very acute phase, which I mentioned just a moment ago, that recession circa 1973, 74. And frankly, those 2 years were the years that brought everyone's attention to the price action in the Dow, which to that point had been kind of ambiguous. The market was volatile, but it was range-bound. It wasn't disastrous. There was just enough in the markets to keep people hopeful. 73, 74 really got dicey. But in large part, because you were range-bound, a lot of investors sort of kept their seats hoping for the best. So again, it was not the cataclysmic 1930s-style collapse, but kind of a grinding sideways in between the Dow 600 and 1,000 on the index, and it just floated for over a decade. But the problem was the real returns were damaged more and more as inflation went from the equivalent of a low-grade headache to sort of seizure-worthy migraine status. inflation really began to exaggerate the downside in terms of real returns in that period.
Well, and I sometimes wonder if it's not better to just have the 30 or 40% crash versus this grinding on, because people don't really realize what's occurring to them. The inflation is just eating them alive and they're getting no return.
It took the better part of 2 days for my daughter to toy with a Band-Aid that was on her arm. And she just, I mean, it was half off and she just, it hurt so bad. And I just
she
walked,
wouldn't pull it off completely.
No, she wouldn't. It was too painful. Yeah. And so I just walked by, and in about a nanosecond, it was gone. And she looked at me like, what have you done? And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, I'm glad that it's done. And the, you know, by the late 70s, it was a disaster. You remember, again, in real terms, because inflation was the deal, the real deal, by the late 70s was a total disaster. And anyone who had stayed in with the hope of financial market gains, they ended up being the biggest losers.
Yes, but if you owned gold.
Yeah, if you owned, frankly, any tangible assets in that period of time, you were one of the biggest winners. You were one of the smarter ones. Now, of course, selling those assets at a high price at the zenith was also wise. Hmm. And the Bass brothers come to mind. I've told this story many times, but for new listeners, I think it's worth retelling. The Bass brothers, Texas family, made their fortune in the oil patch. Oil, gas, land, all very real things. And they brought on a gentleman by the name of Richard Rainwater. He came over and worked for them from his stint at Goldman Sachs. And his advice and counsel to them was to start liquidating in the late 70s some of their physical tangible assets, which they did. And in terms of market timing, for those who think that markets can't be timed, I would beg to differ, and so would the Bass brothers. They still are worth billions and billions of dollars because of Richard Rainwater's advice and what was technically market timing, moving from one market to another in a very propitious way at a very propitious time. So out of tangibles into cash for about a year, year and a half, and then ultimately 1982, they backed up the truck, and in the infant stages of a bull market in stocks, they bought very, very well, inexpensive shares, and they rode the equity bull market up into the mid-1990s.
Well, and I think it's important to point out that at that time that they did that, you could buy the Dow for an ounce of gold, and by the time it was finished in 2000, it went to 43 ounces of gold.
That's a 43 ounces of gold.
That's incredible.
Right. It's 17 to 18 now, and I think we're working our way back towards a 1-to-1 ratio where gold buys you a lot of shares, and then guess what? You play the ratio the other direction, and you wait for your shares to buy you a lot of gold. Mm-hmm. And if you could remain relatively agnostic as an investor and be patient, and I think the patience factor is something that definitely grinds on people. Daily volatility takes people out of playing this long game. But if you can play this game between tangibles and intangibles to be able to go from stocks into physical gold back to stocks, into physical gold back to stocks, if you can do that in one generation, let alone in two or three, you're talking about a multiplication of wealth that is beyond your wildest imagination, on par with the lottery, only not quite with those same odds.
And I think that's one of the great advantages of working with this company, Dave. Your dad started it in 1972. We've been through a number of those periods of time where there's a ratio trade. Now, is the period ahead, are we poised for that experience again?
Yeah, and I just want to call it the rainwater. I mean, if you want to conceptualize this and remember the transitions between asset classes, and again, what happened in the late 70s, coming into the 80s, and now where I think we are today, let's just call it the rainwater. Mm-hmm. I think the period ahead is going to need poise. It's going to take experience. You might consider who you're working with, and whether they can carry you through a rising tide of discouragement and the consequences of inflation and market losses. I was watching Dr. Bogle's comments, Mr. Bogle, rather. He's kind of the doctor, or the king, if you will, of passive index investing. Started the Vanguard Group. And he was commenting the other day that he has never seen the likes of first quarter volatility here in 2018. We're up 1,000 points. We're down 1,000 points in a matter of days. And he's flabbergasted. He's never, in his history, he's seen 25% declines in the equity market. He's seen 50% declines in the equity market. He's been investing for over 6 decades, but he's never seen anything like this volatility. I will tell you, I venture to say that this volatility is telling you something. It's communicating something. It's the top of a market. It's behavior consistent with confused models, algorithms that can't fathom a changing financial backdrop, and investors that want to do what has worked for 9 years and thus are buying every dip they can. So the rallies are as sharp as the declines, and it's manic. Manic like money market tops are, with the bulls utterly convinced, even as the fundamentals are failing and the valuations continue to get pushed to the outer limits. Schiller PE is now 31.6. Tobin's Q and other valuation metrics put this market today between the all-time high or in the second or third place. That is, of course, that's the feel-good zone for an equity investor. But as a contrarian, the feel-good zone is also the danger zone. Please take the time, if you didn't read Barron's magazine this last week, April 9th, the interview with, yes, a perma bear. He's one of the two who are still alive, Doug Noland and Albert Edwards at Societe Generale.
Right.
Read the interview in Barron's, and he suggests that the S&P 500 could test the 2009 lows. Again, back to Bogle. If his mind is boggled, not boggled, but boggled by current market volatility, and he said this, "I've never seen anything like this before," his quote. Why was his mind not equally boggled in 2017 when volatility was dead as a doornail, right?
So it played into his philosophy.
Well, I think that's the reality, is we see what we want to see, and we're surprised by the things that we don't necessarily like. From zero to hyper-volatility, it means something, Kevin. It means something. And Bogle is uncomfortable. And I think we could describe this as peak indexing.
Well, and it could be peak passive investing. It could be the end of passive investing. You have to have some form of management. Now, you know, I had mentioned Fred Hickey earlier, and he, of course, was on the Barron's Roundtable. You just mentioned Barron's magazine. Let me read you a paragraph that I read the other day that he wrote, and I thought it was so powerful because so much right now is driven by algorithms that really are written for this 9-year period that you're talking about, this low volatility period. He says, "Here's the challenge to humans that program the algorithms, the algos, the computer models that drive much of today's buy and sell decisions." He says, "Go ahead and plug these variables into your computers." Okay, coming up, a Fed rate hike cycle, one of the three highest value stock markets in history. The other two, by the way, ended in crashes. One of the oldest economic expansions in history, 105 months, and margin debts that have tripled in size off the previous low and are nearly more than double the prior record level in 2007 before the last crash. I won't ask you to calculate the impact of $90 billion worth of quantitative tapering. That's pulling money off the market. That's scheduled to occur in the second quarter, and $120 billion of quantitative tapering in quarter three, or $150 billion in quarter four. The Fed is selling assets. It's never attempted this before. And he says, "What do your computers say are the odds of a recession and a bear market? If the answer is anything less than 99%, you're lying."
Right. So, I mean, Art Cashin, you'll often see him on CNBC.
Right.
He echoes Mr. Index, Mr. Bogle. He says, "It's unfortunately reminiscent of some of the volatility we saw in 1987. You know, the idea that you can start to tighten, as Fred mentions, and take money off the table and not have an impact in the financial markets is ludicrous. And it is happening. It does bring to mind, can they actually continue to raise rates? What are the consequences if they do so? But here's just kind of to end this idea on a technical note on the volatility piece. You've got prices on any one of these rallies. Prices are increasing. They're rising on diminished volume. And when the prices are falling, it's doing on increased volume, right? So this is a sign of distribution. Distribution precedes a cascade in price. Beware. This is a real time to be aware of some of those nuances. Again, just to restate, as the market is rallying, it's on thinner and thinner volume. As the market is declining, it's on heavier volume. For any market practitioner, that signals the beginning of the end.
And I was looking at Newman's chart on margin debt okay, which is always a guarantor of a crash. And, you know, right before the crash, I had to put it in terms I was telling you the other day.
It doesn't tell you when. It just tells you that it will.
When margin debt gets to be this high, you're going to have a crash. And so he shows a chart that goes back for the last two crashes. And, you know, when you get back to 1999, margin debt had gotten to a point. Now, I likened it to mountain elevations because when I was in my 20s, I climbed a peak in, you know, the Front Range of Colorado called Long's Peak.
That's 14,000 feet.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Now, that would be, if the listener's imagining this, pretend like that's the peak of margin debt, the 14,000 feet.
Circa 1999 to 2000.
Yeah, 99 to 2000. Then, of course, in 2007, 2008, before the next crash, we had the next peak, which would be likened to Denali, okay, 20,000 feet. You know, so a good almost third higher than Long's Peak. But I looked at the chart, Dave. I looked at the chart and it was like, oh my gosh, margin debt right now. Okay, now the other two led to crashes, but margin debt isn't Long's Peak at 14,000. It's not Denali at 20,000. It's well beyond Everest at 29,000 feet. Now, well, I can throw billions of dollars out and it doesn't mean anything, but if you think about the difference between a 14,000 foot peak and a 29,000 foot peak.
The rarefied air of where jets fly.
Exactly. This is where we're at. So the fall will be tremendous.
Well, you know, also in the issues that we'll cover on the conference call this next week with Doug, Russia, China, the trade tariffs,
right,
fresh sanctions. And again, we'll cover this in detail in the Tactical Short conference call next week. For now, it's sort of the tit for tat. $50 billion, that's kind of the back and forth. Now we offer $100 billion, that's announced in trade items to be subject to tariffs. Soybeans are one of the things that are promoted, $14 billion in soybean tariffs from China as a reprisal back to us. I think the thing that you need to look for as a listener is things are accelerating to the downside. Things are getting nasty if the Chinese begin to liquidate U.S. treasuries. I mean, again, we're getting to a negotiating table and there's a point to throwing and bandying these things about, but U.S. treasuries end up getting to our soft spot. That'll get our attention.
Well, we now have foreign policy. Now, maybe making enemies around the world. I mean, we did this show for 8 years during the Obama reign. We were appalled at what we thought was an incoherent foreign policy, or maybe it was coherent, maybe it was purposeful. You know, we've had Dinesh D'Souza on in the past, and he would say, oh yeah, Obama knew what he was doing on our foreign policy. But whether it was planned or not, it was very, very different. It damaged our world stance, but at this point, what you're seeing is allies being made between Russia, China, Iran. We're almost forcing the issue, aren't we?
It seems like an inadvertent corralling. It again, yeah, you're right. There's been damage done, but we continue to encourage the alignment of interests between Russia and China, Persia, modern day Iran. And it strikes me as a little dangerous to be encouraging a new oil and trade troika when our own energy independence from the Middle East has a half-life to it. Yeah. So we're importing less from OPEC now than at any time in history because we've found new oil reserves here in the United States. But again, there is a half-life to that. We're not talking about a reserve that has an infinite time frame to it. While we are in the process now of extricating ourselves from the Middle East and in the process of confusing the old relationships with the Saudis and others in the region, it's worth remembering that these oil reserves that we have here in the U.S., they're great for as long as they last. And our foreign policy should avoid encouraging too many deep alliances amongst countries that don't particularly like us. So, I mean, we are in the international community fast becoming like the paper cut and lemon juice boys. I mean,
well, and
we're just,
America,
we're an annoyance.
Yeah, and America, it has built its entire power base on two things. Energy, the petrodollar, and currency, the reserve currency status.
Well, so arguably, if you wanted to say the trade wars, you know, predate Trump, they do, because we're talking about trade and currency wars, which were started when Nixon ratcheted up the currency debasement in 1971, closed the gold window into the Bretton Woods arrangement, and that was the first major foray into that particular war. Yeah, I mean, the privileges that we have today are not necessarily guaranteed forever. Energy and currency stability both come to mind reserve currency status is not a guaranteed status. Ask all the countries that had it before us and lost it. And energy independence, while profoundly positive in the short run, this is a massive windfall for us, right? But while profoundly positive, it is not to be held as a permanent economic fact or state of affairs. We should be using the fat years to prepare for the lean. That is how commodity producers typically operate, how we should be operating. Many of the resource companies that have provided this energy windfall for us, they are ill-prepared for what lies ahead, either in lower commodity prices, if we should see that. I don't think we will, but certainly they're ill-prepared for a Fed rate hike cycle. Yeah, increasing the cost of borrowed funds puts your marginal creditor in current junk status at risk. And many of the oil and gas innovators who've brought new supply to market, they fit this category. They're junk bond dependent. And right now we're watching the 10-year treasury march inexorably towards 4%. Reverse that trend. If you read Barron's and the article, the interview with Albert Edwards, he would argue, no, treasuries are going to see their rates decline yet again because of the panic out of equities. He may be right, but he also acknowledges that he may be wrong and he may see a blowout in bond yields. So we will see. If the 10-year treasury marches to 4%, there are effects to be felt in the energy complex. And this is, I think, again, not to make this too complex, but it doesn't take a lot to bankrupt the companies that are giving us an energy windfall with an increase in the cost of capital. So what happens in the treasury market is very significant to our energy independence. And note how we're gloating over our energy independence. And at the same time, because of it, recreating relationships or undoing old relationships in the Middle East. So this is a nasty marriage from the outset. Long term, why are we forcing this marriage between Russia and China and Iran? It wouldn't be the first time we've done this, Kevin, but I fear we are again preparing for the next war in part by creating the next enemy.
I'll never forget, there was a book that your dad gave me in the late 80s before the Berlin Wall came down, written by Anatoly Golitsyn, called New Lies for Old. And he had fled from Russia, but he had been part of a 50-year think tank of strategies. And this, of course, was still during the Cold War. The Berlin Wall was still up. But he wrote this book saying there were several things that were going to happen. One was the Berlin Wall was going to come down. There would be perestroika. But he also said that at some point, Russia and China would unite. One of the key aspects of the Cold War for the United States was to keep Russia and China separated, because we knew that if they combined, it was a force to be reckoned with. And Russia understood that too. So did China. And they had in the plan, at least that was the Cold War plan at the time, the 50-year plan, was something called the pincer strategy. Now, what's crazy is these trade wars could be creating this pincer strategy, whether they mean to or not.
Yeah, I mean, fresh trade deficit numbers for the United States, larger than any going back to 2008, the ones out this last week. I mean, we have now a very prickly context in which to deal with other issues, right? So if trade is the talking point, and it creates uncomfortable relationships. Have you ever sat at a table where somebody says something and you're just like, that was a party foul. You shouldn't have said that. Right. So that's the
My
way
wife
we,
says I do it all the time.
Well,
yeah.
So that's the way we are right now, sitting at the table with the Russians and the Chinese. Mm. Now, if you're in the context of everyone feeling uncomfortable and a little sick to their stomach, and you all of a sudden have an issue with Taiwan, or you've got the South China Sea all over again, those flashpoints, they're dealt with differently if you're on friendly terms versus unfriendly terms. And I think trade is just a broader context. Again, we're entering the second chapter of a trade war, which began in 1971, or the second volume, maybe. Perhaps we should look at it that way.
Well, you know, it's not just trade wars that are occurring. We may have a constitutional crisis on our hands at this point, with Cruz going in and actually confiscating records.
Yeah, when Mueller sent his folks into Trump's lawyer's office this week, I mean, I think they may have stepped into it this time. Watergate was a constitutional crisis of sorts. But what is seizure of privileged data from Trump's attorney's office, and how can it be used? What does the law have to say about that? I mean, Watergate, I think, is shrinking in significance relative to this. I would guess that the unintended consequence is that Trump's voting base is reinvigorated in ways that the left never could have imagined by these sort of tactics. 2018 elections are going to get very interesting. And if you did think that 2016 was a peak vitriol in the political sphere? Guess again. You ain't seen nothing yet. Welcome to Chapter 2 in the saga of a divided nation.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'd like to encourage you to register for the Tactical Short Quarterly Call with Doug Noland and David McIlvaney this next Thursday, April 19th. You can register by going to the website mwealthm.com and just click on the link there. You can call us here at the office anytime at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.